Excellent. We might get started, I think. Welcome to the first Oxford Transitional Justice Research Seminar for the year. It's very good to see everybody, particularly in first week, because I know how busy it is. So great to get a very good crowd for our first seminar. It's a real honour this evening to have with us Professor Miles Houston, who I know is already very familiar to many of you. So I'm not going to elaborate enormously on Miles's background. I'm sure much of it will also become familiar as he begins to speak to us. But Miles, of course, is a chair in social psychology and a fellow at New College here in Oxford. He's published very widely, particularly in the field of experimental social psychology. I think, as we're going to find out this evening, he's obviously done an enormous amount of research in Northern Ireland, looking at a whole range of issues relating to social cohesion and intra-ethnic relations. He's published very, very widely. He's a former editor of the British Journal of Social Psychology as well. And this evening, he's going to speak to us on the topic of contact and conflict in Northern Ireland, a society in transition to reconciliation. And I think there's a question mark after that. Over to you, Miles. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
I don't know if I have to lurk behind this thing, or will this work if I stand over here?
Does anybody know?
No. Okay.
I can.
It's going to happen.
If you point it at this.
That's there.
Okay.
No. Up to there, you think?
Yeah.
That may just be the proof.
sounded good.
Sounded confident, right?
So obviously, the trick you play on all speakers. There's normally a keyboard or a mouse here to advance this thing. Any help?
Is there not one in the cupboard?
Yeah, just.
But I'd have to get that in the cupboard every time.
Just slide that up as well.
Ah, there we go. That's fine. Just leave that. Yeah. Lucky I'm slim. Right. Okay. So it feels a bit formal here. So as soon as I can, I will get back over there and merge with you. But I'm very happy to present to you this evening. I've long heard about these meetings. Actually, never managed to get to one of them. It was just incredibly busy, like everybody else. So very nice to be here. Nice to see a couple of people that I recognise, and since I sold my house to one of them, I hope you've gone and everything is okay in the house. Otherwise, the questions are going to be terrible. So, by way of an outline, let me just emphasise, I'm a social psychologist, I probably have a very different approach from lots of people in this room. Are you lawyers, historians, political scientists, sociologists?
Bit of everything. Mixed bag.
So I'm going to try and give you a 45-minute overview of about 10 years of research, so selected highlights of it. I'm not going to go into great detail about how exactly we measured a particular item in a particular survey. Very happy to take questions on any of those kind of things. And I'm going to talk fairly generally about the sorts of phenomena that we have been involved in. So my particular take on Northern Ireland is only one of many. I'm interested in a thing called the contact hypothesis. It's just the idea, core idea in social psychology for about 50-odd years, that positive contact between members of groups can be associated with improved intergroup relations, reduction of prejudice, and so on. My main contribution to that work has been many, many papers and studies in lots of different places, trying to get a better understanding of how contact works, by what processes does it improve intergroup relations, and we call those things mediation effects in psychology, and also when contact works. So does contact work better, for example, when people are aware of their group memberships, or when they somehow manage to bury those differences? We call those moderation effects. And I'm also going to introduce you to a distinction. I'm guessing a few of you will have come across the idea of intergroup contact, direct contact. I'll be surprised if many of you have come across the idea of extended contact, because that's more recent. And I think that's a really clever idea, and I'm able to say that because it's not my theory. It's an approach that argues that even if we don't have any direct contacts with we might have someone, particularly a close friend, in our particular group who has a friend in that other group. So we might have an indirect or an extended contact effect. Some people sometimes call it contact at one degree of separation. And it sounds like kind of a mild effect. If there's a sociologist out there who knows about Granovetter's work on weak ties, I think it's a pretty good example of what he had in mind there. So I'm going to then lead in after those first kind of studies. I'm going to look at some work which we've just completed doing, two separate studies, one cross-sectional and one longitudinal, in mixed and segregated neighborhoods in different parts of Northern Ireland. And then finally, I'm going to look at a couple of data sets we have on mixing at school and mixing at university. Ask what might seem like the blindingly obvious question: does it matter? Is it a good thing? Is it helpful? And some useful, slightly surprising results there, and conclusions, and I hope lots of discussion. Okay, some key facts about Northern Ireland. I've already met the ringer, the member displaced from Northern Ireland to our audience today. I'm always extremely nervous about giving these sort of 5-minute potted histories. But for people who know nothing about it, it's quite useful, okay? You know, population 1.5 billion. You sort of need to know that to make any sense when somebody says to you 3,600 people were killed in the Troubles. Otherwise, it's fairly meaningless. Roughly equal-sized groups now, the demographers vary about exactly when the tipping point may come and pick up a community may outnumber the Protestant community. Those groups are really ethno-political groups. I'm going to talk about religion very briefly in a second, but the divide is primarily a political divide. It's about whether people want to remain part of the United Kingdom or whether they want to reunify Ireland. What are the consequences? As I said, that's the number of deaths, also been a massive number of often horrendous injuries. And because Northern Ireland is a very small, highly interconnected society, when somebody gets killed, when somebody gets injured, you get this very strong trickle-down effect. If you do national probability sample surveys in Northern Ireland, you find something like 40% of the population knows somebody who has suffered really adverse consequences. That's what got me interested in studying things like trust and forgiveness, as well as intergroup attitudes. Catholics and Protestants. The way we use those terms, and my long-term collaborator in this work has been Ed Cairns, who's at the University of Ulster in Coleraine. He argues in his paper with John Darby that those identifying labels are as much ethnic and political as religious. And this is a real mouthful, because it means you have to refer to them as ethno-political groups, and you go through whole chapters doing this. But it is an awful lot more accurate than to call them religious groups for our purposes. You may also, if you don't know Northern Ireland, you may say, well, how the hell does anybody know who's a Catholic and who's a Protestant? And there are actually some interesting studies, because both Catholics and Protestants think that they can tell the difference. And research seems to indicate that neither of them can do, which is a good thing. You can tell them by their first and family names. You can tell them by their schools, their home addresses, their employers' identities, their sports clubs, and other information. With that kind of information, studies have shown that you can tell with over 90% accuracy which community somebody belongs to. One of the reasons why religion seems to be important is that church membership and attendance are so high. They're much, much higher than they are in the UK. Through my years in Northern Ireland, one of the words that I have learned to stop using is the mainland. My friends in Northern Ireland tick me off, sometimes hit me when I ever use that word. Another is the province. And the other thing I think you're not supposed to say is out there. Never going out there. You're allowed to say over there. But you know, they're very subtle nuances of language, which are important. But people perceive religion to be the cause. I'm really not going to talk about religion tonight. This is just getting it out of the way here. In some of our studies, we have measured religion, more specifically religiosity, the extent to which people endorse particular belief. It doesn't actually account for a great deal of the data backing up the idea that these are not really religious conflicts that we're talking about. And Cairns and Darby, in that article, say of the many interrelated causes, because religion, or more correctly, theology, is probably the least important. There is another quotation attributed to Dean Swift, who says we have just enough religion to make us hate and not enough to make us love one another. And that's actually quite a wise remark about the role of religion in prejudice generally, because there is evidence that some forms of religion make prejudice and other forms of religion unmake prejudice. Because I'm interested in intergroup contact, Northern Ireland is a fascinating place because it's highly segregated. It's segregated on almost every significant dimension you can imagine. Education. I've given talks in this country to people who are absolutely staggered when I give them these data. But you know, there is a level of segregation educationally that is very, very hard for most people in this country to understand. Also high demographic segregation, low rates of intermarriage. And a number of commentators have argued that that segregation is what sustains the conflict. There's ignorance, there's suspicion, there's mistrust. And what contact is all about is trying to overcome those ideas. So that's a map of what's called the religious distribution in Belfast. If that city were made up of areas that were all highly mixed, the whole map would be that colour. Okay. Instead, what you see is large swathes of red, which are 0 to 20% Catholics, mainly Protestant areas, and swathes of green, 81 to 100% Catholic. Okay? So where does social psychology come in? Well, the contact hypothesis argues that you can do something about prejudice and conflict by introducing people to members of other groups under appropriate or specific conditions. And those are, in a nutshell, common goals, get people working on common projects, get them cooperating. Even if it's a society where there is unequal status, create equal status in the contact situation, and have institutional support. It's no good getting kids from one school together with kids from another school when the kids from one school hear their teacher say, sorry kids, you've got to go, it's a complete waste of time, but you've got to do it. That's no good, that's not going to work. I'm not really going to talk tonight about all the other stuff we do, I'm just focusing on Northern Ireland, but we have done studies on this topic in Malaysia, in India, in so many different countries, and have a big project running in Cyprus that might be of interest to people in this group as well. It's absolutely amazing how profound the effect is. There was a meta-analysis published in 2006 of over 500 studies on intergroup contact, conclusively demonstrating a reliable effect across these studies. So contact would help because it would undercut this massive segregation. Now, I'm not the first person to have done research on this topic. Is there an anthropologist in the house?
You found an area we don't cover, that's extraordinary.
Okay, well, that's the moment where I pay tribute to Harris, it's Rosemary Harris, who published a great book in 1972 about the extent to which Catholics and Protestants coexisted, particularly in rural areas, shared farming equipment, did certain things together, and didn't do other things together. So you learn to coexist in a certain kind of a way. Government policy is absolutely predicated on the contact hypothesis. This is was the moment when I started to get interested in doing work in Northern Ireland, when a colleague then showed me a government pamphlet which was drawing on some of our work, and by that time we hadn't done a single study in Northern Ireland, so I thought maybe we better do. Much of that work's been exploratory, tends to have been rather poor methodologically, as you'll see. I'm into my hard data and my statistical analyses. I think if you're going to claim to government and other people that things are worth doing, you have to have the evidence to back it up. So generally, this work was characterized by rather poor measures and by worse analyses. So before going into our work, what are the key kind of questions? To remind you, I'm interested in what processes make contact work, when it works. How do we address what we call the $60,000 question, making sure that contacts between individuals from different groups don't just lead to an improvement in attitudes towards one person, one member of the group, but actually to generalized change in attitudes about the out-group as a whole. And beyond attitudes, every social psychologist is involved with attitudes, but attitudes may not be the most important thing. You know, does the future of Northern Ireland really rely on Catholics and Protestants liking each other? Probably not. It probably relies much more on them trusting each other, forgiving each other, taking each other's perspective on certain issues. So we've had a look at some of those measures in our research as well. So theoretically, when we have looked at this question of how contact works, we have come to the conclusion, again, empirically based, that contact works primarily by changing the feelings people have about our group members, which sounds a bit touchy-feely, but isn't really. It's getting to the fact that an awful lot of prejudice is tied up with negative intergroup emotions, things like anxiety and threat and fear, and even stronger ones like contempt and disgust. Contact works by reducing those negative feelings and also by promoting positive feelings. Particularly effective is actually to promote empathy and perspective taking, trying to get people to see the world through other people's eyes. So let me go into my first study and try and lead you fairly slowly through the first one so that I can hopefully go a bit faster through the other one. This is a cross-sectional study. And if you're a bunch of gung-ho empirical researchers like myself, you'll immediately go, ooh, cross-sectional, how do you know what causes what? Legitimate question. We'll try and resolve that later with some longitudinal data. This is a cross-sectional study. It's a representative sample of Northern Irish adults. I'm going to go through the main measures for you, not item by item, but just give you an essence of what we're measuring. So predictors, these are the things that we think will lead to something else. We distinguish between what we call opportunity for contact and contact itself, and our prime measure of contact is contact with out-group friends. That's because research has found that that is the most powerful vehicle for changing prejudice, having friends in the out-group. The key distinction there is that just sharing a space with other people, whether it's a seminar room or a housing estate or an organization where you work or a school, just sharing that space with them doesn't mean that you engage in contact with them. Generally, seminar rooms are a good example because you look around and you think, I know half the people in this room but not the other half, and at the end you'll have a drink with the half that you do know, and then you'll go away and you still won't talk to the other half. So you haven't had contact, you've just had the opportunity for contact. Then we go to the mediators. These are what we think are the measures that underlie the effects of contact on outcome measures. And here we're looking at one positive one, out-group perspective taking. We want to see if contact can encourage perspective taking from the view of the out-group. And we're looking at intergroup anxiety. And intergroup anxiety is measured by a set of widely used scales which ask people how they would feel if interacting with a group of members of a group of individuals, the other community or group, compared with how they feel when interacting with their own group. Now that's a self-report measure. That's been validated in laboratory studies, which have also fixed people up to electrophysiological recording equipment and shown that indeed people who score highly on the scale do show higher heart rate, other measures of physiological arousal. And then in this study, we've got three criterion variables, the things that we're trying to predict: standard measure of prejudice, measure scale that we've developed in our own research on intergroup forgiveness. All these are multi-item reliable scales, and a measure of out-group trust. I'll go through the first lot of data, and then we'll pause a bit and just see if there are any questions about how we work that I need to clear up before we go on. So these are the measures that we have, and we have each of these measured reliably, and we are predicting a causal model that will flow from the left to the right. And that's exactly what we find statistically. The more opportunities for contact you have, the more contact with out-group friends you have. The more contact with out-group friends you have, the lower your anxiety and the higher your perspective taking. In a model like this, by the way, every single one of these associations is made statistically while controlling for every other variable in the model. We then have direct effects from contact to each of the outcomes. So contact is associated with reduced prejudice, increased trust, and increased forgiveness. And then we have indirect effects. The contact itself affects both anxiety and perspective taking. It is associated with less anxiety and more perspective taking. And from each of those, there are direct effects on each of the three outcome measures. And we can explain between 30 and 48% of the variance in each of those outcome measures. And generally, in behavioral science, we're pretty happy if we can explain about 30%. There may be questions that may be very different from your approaches, so don't let me plow on and give you another six studies if there's anything that's unclear. Please fire away.
Perspective taking, what you really mean by that? Because there's plenty of contact, you know, well, as you know, it's not a completely mad place, and people are often completely insane.
You could say that.
there are an awful lot of ways that people have contact, and they hold back a lot of their contact. Mm-hmm. So people can, you know, people can be married and not actually engage with each other.
Absolutely.
And that wouldn't be uncommon, actually.
Yeah.
So how do you... Anxiety, I can sort of understand, but perspective-taking...
Well, perspective-taking, you're really asking about the operationalization, how do we measure it? So we ask people a multiple series of items, and these are reworded items that come from, in this case, come from an original scale used in the States by Dan Batson, which is under the work on helping analysis. And we ask people questions like, to what extent do you view troubles in Northern Ireland? Do you try to view the troubles in Northern Ireland through the eyes of a member of the other community, for example? Okay? I can't pick the second item for that one, but they're all self-report items of whether people ever do that. And of course, one of the sadly beautiful things about working in Northern Ireland is that you don't get any problems of socially desirable responding. You get plenty of people telling you they don't like the other group, they don't share the group, they are anxious about interacting. When I do research with Oxford students, I have to come up with clever ways to get around that problem. So, in a sense, your question is more about the contact, I think, because I focused here on the measure of contact with friends. And people will tell us anonymously that they have friends, and they'll actually tell us, because they do in our surveys, anonymously whether they are married. But I was really staggered by the fact that I learned only very recently I knew that one of my collaborators over there, I knew she was in a mixed marriage, and she was saying to me that her colleague, who we've often met together and they're great friends and do lots of things socially, she said, I would never talk to her about this, I would never talk to her about that. So there's this famous phrase associated with Seamus Heaney, whatever you say, say nothing. You know, so people are very guided in what they will say in contact. But these are reliable scales. They ask people how often you have contact, what's the quality of it like, how many friends do you have, you visit them in their homes, so they visit you in your homes, and so on. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Is this all with adults, or are you doing children?
This one is a representative sample of Northern Irish adults. Yeah. We actually today I'm not going to talk about any stuff with younger than university students.
Is it men, or men and women?
No. Men and women.
And the percentage, do we have a different percentage? In the sense, the women were more keen to have less anxiety.
We're not primarily interested in gender effects in a study like this, other than if they moderate the bars in this model, and they don't. So that's not to say there are no differences. Of course, there will be mean differences. And if you're really interested in them for some reason, I can provide you with them. But generally, what you find in these studies is that women have lower levels of prejudice than men. That's almost a universal.
These arrows are all going in one direction, so there's some scope for sort of a loop. As you get more contact, you forgive,
yeah.
And then you get more contact.
Absolutely. There was one other question, but let me answer that question first. So these are cross-sectional data. These are absolutely not optimal for testing that hypothesis. But you can statistically do the reverse paths. And when you do that, actually what you find in this data set, the reverse path from prejudice to contact is not significant. That's why it's a dotted line. Nor is the reverse path from trust, nor is the reverse path from forgiveness. That's not to say they never occur. They do occur. And cross-sectional studies tend statistically to rather underestimate those effects. But you'll see some longitudinal data later. And in essence, yes, we would expect these things, by and large, to be reciprocal. But for a contact theorist, somebody who's interested in using contact as an intervention, as long as this arrow here, this yellow one, as long as this is significant, that tells you that it may be worth investing in contact as an intervention to reduce prejudice, even if the reverse arrow is also there. There was one other question I think I didn't take. No?
No, that's right, sir.
Okay. Let me just mention these results, because sometimes people quite legitimately ask, well, do these things really hold for everyone? You know, what about those people who really suffered? And of course, there's a large number of those people. We took this sample, and we split it into subgroups based on people who had some experience versus no experience of the troubles. Of course, people with greater experience report lower forgiveness and lower trust. We also did the same thing based on an objective, if anything in this world is objective, let alone in Northern Ireland. These are police government data on levels of sectarian violence. So each individual in the survey is geocoded for where they live. You split those people into low versus high areas. Again, it makes sense. You live in a higher area of violence, lower forgiveness, lower trust, less contact with out-group friends. But even having done all that, if you correlate contact with forgiveness and you compare people who have either no or some experience of the troubles, the correlation is reliable in both subsamples. You do the same thing for people who have low or high levels of objective sectarian violence, and the correlation is still reliable in both those subsamples, which I think is a pretty amazing finding. It indicates that contact is something that's not just useful for the liberal, the open-minded, the educated, but can and does have an effect for people who have been most implicated. Actually, my most terrifying story about talking to an audience with people from Northern Ireland is when I was on sabbatical at Stanford and I was invited to talk about this work, and somebody said, "We have a really interesting program on forgiveness in our medical school, and actually we have a bunch of widows from Belfast over here at the moment. I've invited them all to your talk." And I kind of went, "Oh, shit." You know, what would these people think about this educated, middle-class English person professing to talk about their country? And I have to say their response was utterly heartening, you know, and I have never ever thought for a second about giving up the research because of the kind of responses that they had. They believe it's incredibly important. That probably matters more to me than what the journalist is. On to the next question. When does contact work? What we call the moderation hypothesis. This is an idea that I put forward in 1986 with a colleague of mine, Rupert Brown, and at the time people thought we were kind of crazy, because what we were arguing was contra the main American perspective at the time, which was bring people together as individuals, bury the past, bury group differences, what people in interethnic relations call the colorblind perspective. Don't talk about those things. We said exactly the opposite. We said if you do all that, all that you will do is succeed in bringing about some cosmetic change, some friendship between an individual here and an individual there. Actually, what you've got to do is make sure that when this Catholic meets that Protestant, they are aware of their relationships. They see each other as, to some extent, typical of their groups. And that typicality can be just in terms of the names that they have. It doesn't have to be typicality in terms of extreme political attitudes. And we test that effect using similar cross-sectional data. And I'll point out here, emphasize, these are data from University of Ulster students who collected lots of studies in Queens and Jordanstown and Coleraine primarily. Most psychologists spend their lives apologizing for studying the white rat and the sophomore student, the first year fresher or whatever it is. But actually, students are really interesting to study in Northern Ireland. Were you an undergraduate in Northern Ireland?
No, I was an undergraduate here.
Here. And because it's really fascinating for many people, going to university is the first time that you mix. And we'll come back to that at the end of the topic. So I don't think we need to apologize for studying students. They are an important part of the whole mix. The new variable we added to this study is identification. We had a measure, a multi-item reliable measure, of how strongly people identify as Catholics or Protestants. As you would expect, that's negatively correlated with contact. The more strongly identified you are, the less contact you have. As before, and that is also associated with less forgiveness. Contact is associated with reduced anxiety. It's associated with more positive attitudes and forgiveness. The two new bits of the model are that's mediated, again, by anxiety. The two new bits are the moderation parts. If you look at this part, from contact with friends to outgroup evaluation. Phil, I'm beginning to feel sorry for your neck. Do you want
no,
to
it's
everything
fine.
I'm going to yeah. say today is going to be here? If you want to move over there.
It's fine, cheers.
This part here, which is reliable overall, is actually only significant for people who reported being aware of respective group memberships during contact. For those people who said contact was associated with low salience, that part is not significant. Get exactly the same effect with this path down here, from contact with friends to forgiveness. There's very strong support for our approach, which is that it's no good having this cosmetic interpersonal contact. It's got to be category-based. It's got to be group salient contact. Okay, moving on to extended contact. A phrase that's strongly associated with prejudice and the study of prejudice coming from the United States is the phrase that people use, some of my best friends are. It's generally followed immediately by Jews are mean, Scots are mean, Germans are boring, you know, or whatever the ethnophilism, the stereotype is. It's, when people use that phrase, they're generally about to reveal their prejudices. So I call this some of my best friends have friends who are, because it's the indirect effect. It's important to emphasize that it's secondhand. It's not face-to-face contact. It seems very weak on the face of it. And yet, Steve Wright and his colleagues in the States proposed this idea that just knowing somebody from your group who had a cross-group friend could improve your attitudes to the out-group. There are many advantages to this, but they include the fact that any particular cross-group friendship could be widely shared. Imagine a primary school class of 20 kids, and one of those kids has an out-group friend. There is the potential for that friendship to be talked about, observed, and shared by multiple people. The other advantage is that an observed cross-group interaction is likely to be associated with less anxiety than one that you're directly involved with, especially if you have low levels of prior contact. And we tested this effect in a paper. We published two studies, one based on students, one based on a representative sample. I'm just showing you the students. We measured the number of direct friends, and we measured the number of indirect friends. So this one here is people saying, responding to the question, how many in-group members do you know who have out-group friends? Both of these are associated with reduced anxiety, and anxiety is associated with more prejudice to the group and with a lower tendency to see the group as variable as opposed to homogeneous. And the important bit to emphasize about this analysis is, again, every path you see there is controlling for all the other variables. So this effect here, from number of indirect friends reducing anxiety, promoting variability, through anxiety reducing prejudice, that is a measure that controls for the number of direct friends that people have. Is indirect contact or extended contact, is it important for everyone? Is it important for people who live anywhere in the country? As you would predict, extended contact works best for those people who themselves have very little or no direct contact. That makes good sense. If you have direct face-to-face contact, why would you fall back and rely on this rather mild form of contact? We can show that in this graphic by looking here at the level of indirect contact people have, low or high, and looking here at whether they are low or high on cross-group friendships. So people who are high on cross-group friendship, people who have a substantial number of out-group friends, their levels of bias are not affected by how much indirect contact they have. That's a flat line. But these people here who don't have much direct face-to-face contact, bias is much lower for those people who have high and for those people who have low indirect contact. So we think that this is an incredibly potentially powerful effect, and government people in Northern Ireland seem to be convinced of this effect too, because it's a form of contact that could be helped, especially useful for people who live in segregated areas. And that takes us nicely on to studies in mixed and segregated neighbourhoods, because all our work so far has been either national probability samples or university samples. And here, what we've done is actually we've gone out and we've gone to particular areas that looked of interest. Now, this gives you some indication of segregation, but it's been estimated that about 40% of the population live in completely segregated neighbourhoods in Northern Ireland. We studied six Northern Irish towns. For complicated reasons, in this study we avoided Belfast because we were doing Belfast in another study. We selected these towns very carefully by working with a demographer at the University of Ulster and working with census data. We take a random sample, not of the country as a whole, but of the people who live in each of those neighbourhoods. We match those neighbourhoods as carefully as possible. You can have such fun with the census. It's amazing the things that you can look up there. You can look up how many people have free meals, how many people dine before 60. You probably should look these things up before you buy a house. You
know? I did.
Yeah.
That's
fine.
So we end up with a large final sample split across these areas. I thought I'd just sort of introduce this line of work. But this was funded by the ESRC program on identities. And part of our brief was to look at a range of identities and see how important people said they were. So you give people multiple items. You say, how proud are you of your membership in this group? Do you feel other people view this group membership positively, and so on? There had been some work published in Northern Ireland which had claimed that the old identities were falling in their importance. When you think that the maximum on this scale is 5, it's fairly hard to argue that these things are unimportant. So these are identities associated with ethno-religious groups and national groups, British or Irish. And then these are what we call common in-group, that's Northern Irish identity, and the neighbourhood. There's always one of these weird little things that appears courtesy of Bill Gates, because I use a Mac, so ignore those symbols there, they don't mean anything at all. So this one we'll come back to here, but there is a theoretical perspective in the United States called common in-group identity, which argues that you can do a lot to oppose prejudice by taking members of opposing groups and finding superordinate identities that they share. Northern Ireland sounds suspiciously simple. Oh, great, all you have to do is make everyone feel Northern Irish and the problem's solved. But of course, it's very, very complicated because you have a whole section of the population that doesn't feel Northern Irish, doesn't wish to be Northern Irish. We'll come back to that too. So what we did in this study is we looked, first of all, at predictors, and here we're differentiating between whether people live in segregated and mixed areas. So we're going to follow up, first of all, and just test the idea that these people in the two kinds of neighbourhoods that have different levels of contact. We're also going to measure two types of threat. I don't want to say a great deal about these, but there are various measures of threat that can be used and were used. Distinctiveness threat is the threat that you see the other group posing to your group's distinctiveness. Social identity theory, which is a very important approach in social identity, argues that we join groups and we remain in groups to a large extent to have this feeling of distinctiveness. And we're looking here at moderators in terms of identification. We're going to look particularly at the link between perceived threat and the amount of bias that you show. And we're going to look at how strong that effect is for people who are strongly identified as Catholics or Protestants. And we're also going to look at how strong or weak that effect is for people who are strongly identified with the Northern Irish identity. And we're predicting levels of in-group bias. So we find segregated versus mixed neighbourhoods. The more mixed it is, the more direct contact you have, the more extended contact you report. Also, the less distinctiveness threat, and also a small effect on bias. Both direct and extended contact are associated with less threat, but you'll see in a minute that the path from distinctiveness threat, that's this one and this one, the strength of that path varies considerably depending on whether people identify predominantly with the Catholic or the Protestant group or with the Northern Irish group. First of all, I'll just show you these salience effects. These are just like the ones I showed you from the Northern Irish students study. Contact works primarily for people who report high salience during contact. You have to feel yourself somewhat to be a group member. You have to be interacting with someone else, at least somewhat, in terms of their group membership. Otherwise, you won't generalize from the individual to the group as a whole. This is the moderation by subgroup identification. That link between threat and bias is statistically higher for those people with high subgroup identification, those people who identify strongly as Catholics or Protestants. The same is true for esteem threat, and exactly the opposite effect for common in-group identification. The more you endorse the high common in-group, the more you feel Northern Irish, the less you allow that perception of threat to be associated with bias. So this is again indicating some of the things that people might want to try to do in interventions that guide people towards different forms of identity. And nowadays people are moving away from a sort of model that says subgroup versus superordinate identity towards a dual identity model that says, can we allow people, whether it's in terms of race or gender or here in ethno-religious identity, can we allow people to keep those group memberships which are highly valued, but also to allow that there is a shared common in-group identity as well? And there are some famous examples where perhaps in Northern Ireland people have shown that identity, albeit very short term. You look too young to remember the boxer Barry McGuigan.
He was a child.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Became a world boxing champion at featherweight or something like that. Massive support from working class men of both backgrounds. More recently, Ulster became European rugby champions. They won the final, played in Dublin. Coachloads of people who had never watched a rugby match in their life went from Northern Ireland, from both communities. This can be done, but my own view is it can only be done short term. And you shouldn't expect, and then we can talk about it in the discussion, but social psychologists could give you good reasons why people don't endorse these superordinate identities a great deal of the time. It's not very distinctive. You don't walk around Oxford going, I'm a student at Oxford. It's not very distinctive. People ask you, oh, what are you doing? You don't say, I'm a student here. You say, I'm reading human sciences, or I'm doing this. It's not very useful or distinctive information. Also in our mixed and segregated research, we've done a longitudinal sample. And this is one of the reasons why we all hate longitudinal work. Somebody's got to do it. Now, you start off with about 1,000 adults, and it's very hard to keep all of those 1,000 in your sample. So we're down to 404 people who completed the survey at time one, and 1 year later at time two. You do all sorts of tests on sample attrition to make sure that the sample that have stayed in are not different from the sample that initially took part. And thankfully, those worked out okay. And this is partly the response to Julian's point, but only partly because I completely accept the reciprocal idea. But here, you measure contact and friendship at time one and bias at time one and time two. What you find, and this is the key effect, you've got these two things here called auto-regressive paths. The measure of friendship at time one predicts the measure of friendship at time two, the same for the measures of bias. But this path here, from friendship to reduced bias 1 year later, is the path the contact theorist wants to see. And that reverse path is not significant. All I can say is two longitudinal studies in Northern Ireland have found this kind of effect. We've also just recently done a three-way longitudinal study of kids in some African schools, and there we've got a much more pronounced reciprocal effect. This, I think, is a really wonderful effect. This is a measure of extended contact at time one, and we used this to test the idea that we had mooted, which was perhaps by observing or learning about people in your group who had out-group friends. Perhaps that will encourage you to take up direct contact in the future. We measured then the direct contact in the neighborhood, quantity and quality of contact, and also contact with friends. We measured that 1 year later, and we find that you can predict from time one extended contact to time two directed contact, controlling for direct contact scores at time one. Which again, this was work funded by the Community Relations Unit in Belfast, and they love this effect. They think this is a really powerful potential basis for interventions and so on. And there's another effect they also like very much indeed. We did this work before a group of Romanians was hounded out of Belfast, and probably everyone here read about. We had followed up this idea, which we call in the literature the secondary transfer effect. This is the idea that contact with members of one out-group might have a sort of trickle-down effect and make you more tolerant and more accepting of members of other groups. And here, our other groups were racial minorities. We've also done other studies more recently. Unfortunately, sectarianism tends to go hand in hand with racism, homophobia, and a number of other delightful forms of human activity. And there are a couple of different theories about how this effect might work. One is just simply through the generalization of affect or the attitude. You form a more positive view to the members of one community, and you just knock on that effect to more positive view of other groups. The alternative is an idea that goes back to some early work by the sociologist Georg Simmel, which has been called deprovincialization. That's the idea that you maybe come to see your own group as less wonderful than you thought it was. You accept that there's good to be found in other groups. So it's a less glorified ethnocentric view of your own group. And we used our longitudinal data effectively to study neighborhood contact with the ethno-religious outgroup at time one. So we asked Catholics about Protestants and Protestants about Catholics. We measured their attitude towards the ethno-religious outgroup 1 year later. We measure their attitude towards their in-group 1 year later. And we measure their attitude towards racial minorities 1 year later. And we control for all these measures taken at time one. And what you can show there is that neighborhood contact is significantly related to the attitude towards the ethno-religious group, just as you find in every contact study. But you get this lovely knock-on effect. It's actually having an effect also on racial minorities. And this little bit down here means that when you do something called a mediational analysis, this effect disappears when you control for this measure here, indicating that that's the effect that is driving it. So people like CRU and Belfast like this effect too, because it seems to suggest that if you invest money, time, and resources in bringing about positive intergroup contact, you won't just change views about one outgroup, but you may well change views and make them more tolerant towards multiple outgroups. Can I end up very briefly just by talking about two small scale studies? Both done on university students, when we quizzed, in the first study, we quizzed people about the number of out-group friends they had at university and at home. We also measured their opportunities at home at university. So these measures would ask people things like how many out-group members, we never use that word, of course, how many Catholics or how many Protestants live near you at home or live near you at university. Those things we find predict the measures of contact. Only the measure of friends at university is directly and negatively associated with less bias that makes sense. They're probably the people that you spend most time with. But the bit that we thought was interesting, we then also built in how much contact these young people had had at home. And those people who had had few friends at home, so had come from fairly segregated backgrounds to mixed universities, for them, the link between friendship and reduced bias was much, much stronger. So going to university, mixing is a good thing. It helps, but it's especially useful for those people who have come to university from rather limited backgrounds. And the last study, we asked people, this is suboptimal, if you had the resources, you'd do it by studying people at primary school and following them up through secondary school and following them up to university. I might talk about that in the discussion, because we have a big, long-term, large-scale project planned at the moment. But we asked university-age students to tell us about their friends at university, the opportunities for contact at university. We asked them to think back to when they were at secondary school and also at primary school, to tell us how much mixing they had done there. And then we predicted their current levels of in-group bias. And as you can see, the more friends you had at secondary school and the more friends you had at university, the less bias you showed. Now you might look at this path here, the dotted line, and you might say, friends at primary school had no effect, so that's unimportant. But I want to emphasize in that model this arrow that is going to appear just there. There's a link, actually, between the friends you have at primary school and the friends you have at secondary school, and in turn the friends at university. So starting them young, to use a Jesuitical phrase, actually does have a payoff. It encourages people to mix with other people. I haven't got data here to show it, but I almost certainly guess that it is associated with less anxiety about mixing with those people, and that reduces contemporary levels of bias. So that's just a subset of what we've been up to over the years. I hope that it's been of some interest to you, not knowing exactly where you come from. I think without any doubt, these results are strong, they're systematic, they're consistent. Contact really does matter. The evidence such as we have is consistent with a causal effect from contact to outcomes, although completely reasonable to expect the opposite too. Everybody knows bigots who avoid contact. Everybody knows open-minded liberals who seek out diverse contacts. We have greatly improved our understanding of how and when contact works, which is important if you're ever going to use it as an intervention. And also understanding that contact works primarily when group memberships are salient. Don't bury these differences under the carpet. Contact works even for those who have suffered. Extended contact complements the effects of direct contact and is especially important for those people in segregated areas, those people who have low opportunities or experiences of direct contact. And finally, I've shown that these threat-reducing effects of contact are moderated by the kind of social identifications people have, whether it's still in terms of their ethno-religious group, ethno-political groups, or whether it's in terms of the more superordinate political identity. Let me just say finally a big thank you, and we ended up with the value of mixing at university and school. Let me just acknowledge that many sources of funding over the years and research collaborators, especially Ed Cairns at University of Ulster and Joanne Hughes. She'd kill me for that, because she's actually now at Queen's University of Belfast and has got to update it. I do apologise for all the complicated path models, but I'll share that one with you.
Great, thanks very much, Miles.